This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Resilience, Children, Hope, Research, and the Environment, with Jane Stevens, founder, publisher of Ace. Is that connected? Is that how I say it, Jane? Ace's Connection. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, University of California, San Francisco, Center for Youth Wellness. Joyce Dorado, University of California, San Francisco, Healthy Environments and Response to Trauma in Schools. And our moderator tonight is James Redford, director and producer, Resilience Documentary. So tonight we will start with James, who is our moderator, and he will introduce you again to our panel. James?
Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Welcome. So, we all know that a rough childhood is a bad thing. Okay? It's an intuitive, obvious point. And, you know, a lot has been going on in this country over the years to help out children who are in tough environments, going through difficult experiences. I think one of the pivotal moments in this movement of trying to bring better care to children who need it over the last 20 years has been the emergence of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, a landmark piece of research that really brought in the biology of stress into the conversation, that started the beginning of a conversation that really looks at the biological dangers of childhood stress and what it does to their development and how that plays out over the long term. It deepened the conversation and it led to all kinds of ideas about what we could do a better job of helping children. This is the core of my last two films that I did with my producing partner, Karen Pritzker. Karen started working with Jack Schoenkopf from Harvard in the early part of this decade when she read the study, and supporting his efforts at the Yale Center for Early Childhood Development, I believe, something like that.
The Harvard and Center on the Developing Child.
I'm sorry, Harvard, because she's at Yale, he's at Harvard. Oh, boy, a lot of Ivy in there. You know, in doing that, we had just finished a film about dyslexia and were casting around for the next topic, and when she clued me into what was going on with adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress and what the biologic risk is, and more importantly, how we can intervene and be helpful, it seemed like an obvious topic and led to two films. Paper Tigers looks at-risk teens and what happens when you're dealing with kids in the educational system who have been subjected to a lot of these unfortunate experiences. How do you bring them back to the fold after they've been impacted? And Paper Tigers looks at some novel trauma-informed practices in that regard. Resilience is a one-hour film that goes deep, more comprehensively into the issue of toxic stress and adverse childhood experiences, and features the work of many of the movement's leaders and inspiring individuals. I'm going to show you that trailer right now. And for those listening, it looks really great.
We all like to think of childhood as this time of joy and innocence. But, I mean, for many of us, it's just not true.
When you grow up in these type of situations, it's not something you talk about. I know I didn't.
The first thing that we found is that adverse childhood experiences are common.
Remember anyway.
Well,
the child may not remember, but the body remembers.
There was this incredible gee whiz effect. You mean adverse childhood experiences cause heart disease and lung disease and liver and cancer?
Exposure to trauma affects children's developing brains. The
the impact is on your behavior, it's on your heart, it's on your DNA. Like, how do you deal with all that?
I don't reach out because I'm not used to that.
We have a whole new body of knowledge now that could open up what we have up till now been seen as intractable, unsolvable problems.
No child should be punched or kicked.
If you can get the science into the hands of the general population, they will invent very wise actions.
Do you feel like any of the interventions have been making a difference?
They made all the difference in the world.
It's there. It's possible. And a defeatist attitude is completely disconnected from what 21st century science is telling us. And we should be going after that like a bear.
So, we have a chance to have a really great dialogue today. The people here on this panel have been working tirelessly and effectively in bringing new and best practices in their fields in terms of trauma-informed practices, whether it's in education or medicine, or as with our first speaker, how do you spread awareness? How do you spread message? How do you change the culture around a certain issue? And Jane Stevens is that person, and I can say from all the research and screenings and talks that I've given on these two films that the roads lead to her. She has single-handedly created the most powerful online community around this issue. Jane is an award-winning journalist. Her articles have appeared in the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, the National Geographic. In her zeal for verite journalism, she has both donned an Oakland Raiders cheerleading outfit as well as written a book. So she's the real deal. And but more to the point, she is this creator of this Aces Too High, which is sort of this online news network for the latest and greatest things happening in this field, as well as this social network community, ACES Connection. And I can't tell you how many times when people ask me a question and I just say, you know what, you got to go on ACES Connection. So, Jane, why don't you come up here and tell us from your point of view what's happening and about your important work in spreading the word about trauma-informed practices, ACES toxic stress.
Thank you so much, Jamie, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for having this wonderful panel tonight. I think that I often listen to the Commonwealth Club's broadcasts and rely on the broadcast to tell me a lot of things that I don't know about. And so I was really pleased that the club was going to be doing this, and I'm humbled and pleased to be here to talk with you about this. To me, this is new knowledge, and I can't emphasize that enough, that this is really a combination of the internet, of GPS, of the World Wide Web, of the iPhone, all rolled in together in this new understanding that we have of human behavior. And what I mean by this is the ACES science. And ACES science starts with the ACE study, and the other four parts of this ACES science are the neurobiology of toxic stress, what happens to the developing brain, the long and actually short-term health and mental health and physical health consequences of toxic stress that are caused by ACEs, the epigenetic consequences of toxic stress, which are how our DNA is changed by our environment and how that is passed on from generation to generation. And then how resilience research is really showing this optimism that all of us have on the panel about how these problems, which have seemed intractable so far to our generations of humans, that we actually can solve them now. We found that our brains are plastic and our bodies want to heal. And so there are a lot of people who are taking full advantage of that not only from learning how cognitive behavior therapy helps kids who have high ACE scores get healthier brains, but also in how you can create a trauma-informed high school and have kids graduate and have hope so that they go on and go to school after they graduate. Yes, really, truly. So before I go off that slide, these are the 10 original ACEs that were looked at. And what's important here is that subsequent ACE surveys are actually looking at many more. And those include racism, bullying, witnessing violence outside the home, outside this building perhaps. involvement with the foster care system, which I think Nadine has included on her ACE surveys of her clients. The World Health Organization has an ACEs questionnaire. They have 43 different types of ACEs on there. So another really important point is that child maltreatment, which I really want to change our term about that to just childhood adversity, is not just violence and neglect. It's divorce, it's living with a family member who's an alcoholic, it's homelessness, it's moving to, you know, 15 different places when you're growing up. Some people call these normal things and you should just get over them, but they actually cause trauma and have the same harmful effects on the brain and the body. Any four ACEs, the ACE study showed, any four ACEs can have the same health consequences as any others. And those four don't have to have any violence in them at all. So that's very important for us to consider, especially as we're looking at our child welfare systems, because the way those are set up are now obsolete in terms of looking at the science. I also think that ACEs science is itself apolitical and acultural. There are people of all walks of life who are learning about this and implementing this in their communities, whether they're Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, you name it. It doesn't matter. This is a human condition. And what affects one person is going to affect another, no matter what their political background is. So what we've learned with this ACEs science is are three really important things here, which is our reaction to adversity, you know, what happens when we experience these things, immediately as well as long-term, the consequences of ignoring that response, and then how to change people's behavior, whether it's criminal behavior, unhealthy behavior, bad behavior, unwanted behavior, whatever. We've been doing it all wrong. So the resilience piece is remarkable, and that's what I'm going to be going into a little bit now here, is how people are using this wonderful knowledge. Dave Lockridge was an evangelical Christian pastor in Merced County when he learned about this through his wife, who's a director of a medical education at a local hospital there. And after he learned about the ACE study, he realized that he'd been doing everything wrong when it came to helping his most troubled parishioners. He'd been telling him to pray harder. And he realized with this that that wasn't going to work. So he closed his church. He went back and got a psychology degree. And he married the epidemiology of ACEs, the neurobiology of toxic stress, and Bible studies. And he took that to rescue missions, where people would... he translated this in a language where those people would trust this language and listen to what he was telling them. Well, what happened as a result of that, and by the way, I don't know how many people in here have actually been to a rescue mission or know people who have been there, but that's pretty much one step away from the grave for a lot of folks. Not only has society given up on them, but they've given up on themselves. So one story that I like to tell from someone I talked with who learned about this was, when she was, I think it was 13 or 14, was sexually abused by her uncle, and she went in to tell her parents, and her parents said, stop talking like that. We don't want to hear about it. things like that don't happen in this household. You're just a dirty girl. So you can imagine how she must have felt, because not only was her experience not acknowledged, but it was her fault. So she said, well, I must be a dirty girl. And she went out and she joined a gang. She started coping by drinking and smoking and doing drugs. She had three kids. All three kids were taken away from her. She ended up in jail. And then she ended up in this rescue mission. And she was sitting across from Dave when he was explaining this ACEs science, which meant that people aren't born bad. What happens to them as children is not their responsibility and not their fault and is not under their control. That whatever they did to cope, they were doing it appropriately, whether it was smoking, because nicotine soothes anxiety, methamphetamines were the first prescription antidepressant, and they were doing this appropriately because they probably weren't offered anything that was healthy. It kept them alive. And the fourth, they can change. So when she heard Dave talking about all this, she sat up and she looked at him and she said, you mean I'm not a dirty girl? And he said, no, you're not a dirty girl. When I met her, she was the administrator of the rescue mission. She'd gone back and she'd gotten her high school degree. She had reconciled with her kids. She had grandkids that she was involved in. She was the most alive, vibrant woman I have ever met, because she had her life back and she had lost it. So that's how this new knowledge can actually change individuals, just their understanding of their histories. But it can also change, this powerful knowledge can change people and the work that they're doing. So, for example, Nadine learned about this and started a revolution in pediatrics. Joyce learned about this and started a revolution in education. Jamie learned about this and has done documentaries that have inspired tens of thousands of people in hundreds of communities around the country to start making changes in their own schools and in their own communities. There are trauma-informed judges, trauma-informed courts, including a wonderful one called the Safe Babies Courts, that have completely changed how they work with families. Instead of separating babies from their parents, they work with the entire family, wraparound services for everybody. If the parents need substance abuse help, they get that. If they need a job, they get help. If the family needs a house, they get that. If they need counseling, they'll get that. And the judge stays on it. So what happens for the kids who go through this court, 99% of the kids that end up in Safe Babies Courts have no further abuse. 99%. I think that's pretty remarkable. Unfortunately, 1% of our family courts are Safe Babies Courts right now. So there are businesses that are beginning to integrate this new knowledge. There are communities that are beginning to integrate this new knowledge. Cowlitz County in Washington was one of several counties that had started implementing this new knowledge of ACEs science. And as a result, they saw huge drops in child injury hospitalizations, suicides, hospitalizations, alcohol arrests, juvenile arrests, dropouts, and truancy. In high school. And what was, I think, most remarkable is that for these, I think it was 9 or 10 counties that were involved in this network, the network that was putting this together was getting $3.4 million a year, and it was saving taxpayers $150 million a year. There's no reason not to do this. So Marshall Gantz, who's a longtime activist and community organizer, he's now at the Harvard Kennedy School, said that every social movement needs stories, structure, and strategies. I launched ACEs Connection Network 5 years ago as a place to tell stories and to provide the structure where people can develop strategies to change what they're doing. So we tell stories on ACEs Too High. It's a new site for the general public. ACEs Connection is a social journalism network. This provides the structure. It has now nearly 12,000 members from all walks of life who are implementing or thinking about implementing trauma-informed and resilience-building practices based on this ACEs science. And they're doing this in their individual, their family, their work, and their community lives. Together, they're developing the strategies that other communities and other individuals are picking up. So what we do on ACEs Connection is not only have the social network and inform you about what's happening out there in the world in this arena, but we also help cities and counties and states start or grow their own ACEs initiatives. We're working with about, I would say, 80 or so communities right now. There are 30,000 cities and towns in the U.S. and 4,000 counties, and we're going to have all of them. We're also becoming, or trying to become, the go-to news and resource hub for how ACEs science is being implemented across sectors like education and pediatrics. We also have a group called Parenting with ACEs, which we first called family violence, and realized that that really wasn't what we wanted to say about this. It's parenting with ACEs. We all are experiencing this. I think this powerful knowledge changes everything. I have an ACE score of 7. Everyone in this room either has an ACE score, has a family member who has an ACE score, works with someone who has an ACE score, and probably for many of you, it's all 3. ACEs are normal. We all breathe the same ACEs air. We're swimming in the same ACEs ocean. We have to talk about this ACEs science and use it because it will help us solve our most intractable problems. It can move us out of the traditional approach of changing unhealthy, unwanted, or criminal behavior from blame, shame, and punishment, which is how we're organized now, to understanding, nurturing, and healing. So right now, our organizations are pretty much set up to manage problems. Generally speaking, we don't really think that we can prevent crime, help people who are homeless, find homes and jobs, make sure that all children receive a good education. We've set our organizations up to manage crime, to shuffle the homeless from one part of town to another, to manage truancy and dropouts and expect, you know, if we get 80% of these high school students graduated, we're doing pretty well. And that's, we don't have to settle for that anymore. This knowledge of ACEs science is moving us from creating organizations that manage problems to creating organizations that manage solutions. So that one day, with your help and your involvement, we can have trauma-informed and resilience-building practices based on ACEs science in our lives, in the sense it'll be like electricity, that we'll only notice it if it's not there. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. So, you know, before I bring up and introduce our next speaker on this issue of what the biology is, I'm going to play a clip from Resilience that explains in more detail this process of toxic stress, what is actually going on in the brains and bodies of our children when they are subjected to what we call adverse childhood experiences.
The reality is that we all need a certain amount of stress, a certain amount of anxiety to perform well. If we don't care about that exam that we're going to have tomorrow, we'll probably fail. If we're going to cross the street and a truck is coming at us, we have release of adrenaline. We have release of a hormone that we call cortisol. We want to jump out of there, and adrenaline and cortisol are going to help us do that. So there's that good amount of stress. But if all day long you're feeling like a truck is coming at you, day after day after day, that's going to take a toll on the body.
And the amygdala, obviously, here has greater activation.
Yes.
In the PTSD.
We were able to image children that had experienced trauma and compare those brain images with children that didn't have an experience of trauma and didn't have symptoms.
right? An exaggerated fear response.
An exaggerated fear response. With decreased activation in areas that we need to control that emotion, in the frontal areas.
Exposure to early adversity and trauma literally affects the structure and function of children's developing brains. So the kid next to them hits them, or the teacher reprimands them in a way that they're uncomfortable with, right? Literally what they're feeling, that activation, is like there was a truck coming at them.
So that hopefully gives you a little bit more intuitive sense as to what's going on. And so let me just start by telling you one little anecdote. When I reached out to Dr. Harris, I read an article about her work in the New Yorker magazine and immediately realized that my goal was to track her down. And I was pretty intrepid, wasn't I?
Yes, you were.
Dr. Harris was on maternity leave, I believe, and rather insensitively, I plotted ahead and managed to get her attention. In the movie, she has a line where she says, you know, I just started out thinking I'm just going to be a pediatrician hanging my shingle up in Bayview Hunter's Point. So keep that in mind as I read her introduction here. She's the founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness, which is a leader in the national effort to revolutionize pediatric medicine and transform the way society responds to kids exposed to significant adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress. She is a esteemed alumni of the TED Talk series, one of the more popular ones, I would say, judged on the YouTube views, serves as an expert advisory on Hillary Clinton's Too Small to Fail initiative, and serves as an advisor on Governor Jerry Brown's Let's Get Healthy California Task Force. She was awarded the American Academy of Pediatrics Award for Humanism in Medicine, as well as this year receiving the Heinz Award for the Human Condition. So, Dr. Harris, we'd love to hear from you. Come on up.
Thank you so much, Jamie. You were rather intrepid. You came to my house, but you brought a babysitter. So I really came into this work of understanding the science of adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress. In my background, when I finished my residency training at Stanford, I started a clinic in one of San Francisco's poorest and most underserved neighborhoods, Bayview Hunter's Point, because I've always had a passion of serving underserved communities, and I believe strongly in addressing health disparities or inequalities in health outcomes. And one of the things that I found as I was doing my clinical practice in Bayview Hunter's Point was that even though we set up a wonderful clinic and we developed the latest clinical protocols, right? Everything I had learned at Stanford, we put it into practice. And we targeted the typical health disparities, right? Immunization rates. We looked at asthma hospitalization rates. We looked at nutritional counseling and pediatric obesity. And we were doing a great job in targeting all of these health disparities. And yet, somehow, I didn't feel like I was making a difference in the life expectancy of my patients. Because in the community that I was serving, violence was the leading cause of early mortality, right? Violence was the number one cause of premature death for Bayview Hunter's Point at the time that I set up shop. And over and over again, I was being referred patients who were sent to me for assessment for ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And so folks in the community, teachers, principals, would say to me, please Dr. Burke, this was before I got married, could you please see, you know, Bobby? He's falling out in class. He can't pay attention. He's got ADHD. Please, can you see him and write a prescription for Ritalin? Right? And I said, sure, send him, you know, please. I'd love to see him. But when I did my job and I really did a thorough history and physical, what I found was that for most of my patients, I couldn't make a diagnosis of ADHD. Most of my patients had such severe histories of trauma that it really seemed like there was something else going on. And one of the things that's really interesting is that if you actually read the diagnostic criteria for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, it gives a whole list of symptoms. And then at the bottom, there's a little asterisk that says, and these symptoms are not caused by any other disorder. Right? And so I stopped and I thought to myself, wow, you know, the common thread here, as I was piecing it together, is that so many of my patients are experiencing horrible stories of trauma. And so I threw myself into the research about how exposure to adversity affects the developing brains and bodies of children. And when I read the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, I think I could actually feel the clouds parting and hear the angels singing. Like it was truly an epiphany. And what we saw in that research study was that when children are exposed to high doses of adversity, not only are they more likely to have mental health and behavioral outcomes like I was seeing among my patients, but they're also more likely to have heart disease, the number one killer in the United States of America. They're more likely to have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and cancer and diabetes and depression. And when I looked at this research, for me, that put these issues squarely into my purview as a pediatrician. And one of the things, when we look at the science, right, there's a couple things that we understand, which is that, number one, childhood is this critical period for development of both the brain and body. One of the things that we are familiar with is this idea that, exposure to adversity affects the brain, right? And we have the last two decades of brain science to build off of in terms of understanding this intuitively of how early adversity might affect different parts of the brain. And we know it affects areas like what we heard about in the film, the prefrontal cortex, which is necessary for executive functioning, right? We see overactivity of areas like the amygdala, which is the brain's fear center. And we see underactivity of areas like the hippocampus, which is responsible for learning and memory. But one of the things that's less intuitive is the idea that every time your stress response is activated, it also activates your immune system, right? Which, when you think about it for a little bit, actually makes a lot of sense, right? So if you are in a situation where you are facing bodily harm, if you're in the street and a truck's about to hit you, if that truck does hit you, you want your immune system to be primed to bring inflammation, to stabilize the wound, right? So that you are able to get away from that situation. And so activation of your stress response also activates your immune response. And that's actually part of the reason why we see increased risk of things like heart disease and cancer. Now, when I understood this research, I literally could no longer continue to do things as business as usual. So we here in San Francisco created the Center for Youth Wellness, with the focus to prevent, screen, and heal the impacts of adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress. And we do this in partnership with the primary care clinic, the Bayview Child Health Center, where all of the clinicians at the Bayview Child Health Center screen every child for adverse childhood experiences. And I'll give you a great example of what that looks like, because very recently I was seeing a patient in clinic, and they were there for their regular physical exam. And as part of the paperwork, you know, we do the developmental screen, we do a screening for autism. And in our center, we also do a screening for adverse childhood experiences. And I had a patient where the mom was concerned about whether her daughter was gaining weight, right? A very reasonable, normal concern. And as I looked at the ACE screen, the score was a 7, right? And I immediately understood that likely the impact on this child's growth was most likely due to the high doses of adversity that she had experienced. And so, rather than doing what this was a family who had moved from out of town, rather than doing what their previous pediatrician had been doing for the past 2 years, which was simply prescribing a nutritional supplement, which, as it turns out, had not been working as this child continued to be off the growth chart, what I prescribed was an intervention developed by Dr. Alicia Lieberman at UCSF called child-parent psychotherapy, where a therapist works with both the child and the parent to do two things. One, support that family in reducing that child's dose of adversity. And two, supporting the caregiver to be a buffer to the adversity that's happening in the home. And there are 6 things that we know make the most difference, that the scientific research shows us make a huge difference in helping to normalize the biology of both the child and the parent. These are sleep, nutrition, exercise, mindfulness like meditation, mental health interventions, and healthy relationships. Now, these sound really simple, and they come in lots of different shapes and flavors, and there are lots of ways to do all of these things. But quite simply, what we know is that if we do evidence-based interventions that help to regulate the biology and also to support the buffering of a caregiver, we can give kids the opportunity to heal and actually change their developmental trajectory, right? And that is incredibly powerful. And we're doing this every day in the Bayview Child Health Center and the Center for Youth Wellness. The last thing that I want to share is that the key to this work, right, one of the things that we feel is critically important and that we're looking to advance at the Center for Youth Wellness is not to keep this science in the journals and in the textbooks. This needs to live in practice. And that is why our communities need to be educated. We need to have a national public education campaign. And our practitioners need to be educated as well. And I'm talking about primary care clinicians, specialists, mental health professionals, teachers, police officers, right? Across the spectrum, we need to understand the impact that early adversity has on the developing brains and bodies of children and the profound way that we can change that with early detection and effective intervention. Thank you.
This is Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Resilience, Children, Hope, Research, and the Environment with Jane Stephens, Dr. Nadine Harris. And now I'd like to introduce you to our speaker, Joyce Dorado, and include also a thank you to our moderator, James Redford, for being here with us tonight. So, Joyce, you're up next.
A word about Joyce. Joyce is the co-founder and director of UCSF Hearts Healthy Environment in Response to Trauma in Schools, a multi-level prevention and intervention program that collaborates with the San Francisco Unified School District to promote school success for students who've experienced complex trauma by creating school environments that are more trauma-sensitive and supportive of the needs of those students. She is an associate clinical professor and the director of clinical research and evaluation at Child and Adolescent Services, a trauma-informed mental health clinic at UCSF San Francisco General Hospital that provides services to children, youth, and families from under-resourced, culturally diverse communities. And I would just say, as a sort of having borne witness to so many things going on in being trauma-informed, that this issue of how we work with kids in the school districts and in any school setting, it's probably one of the more, aside from the healthcare at the pediatric level, the other single most powerful way to introduce healthy practices amidst difficult times. So, Joyce, we look forward to hearing more from you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jamie. I'm going to try to move this closer to me because I'm shorter than everyone else. Here we go. Make this work, and it's working. Here we go. Beginning. All right. So, hi, I'm really glad to be here. I'm knocking things off the table. My name is Joyce Dorado. And I'm going to talk just very briefly about a program that we have been implementing in San Francisco Unified School District since about 2008. Some of my colleagues are here from that program. And I'm also then going to just briefly touch on some of the essential ingredients that we see are necessary to try to help create more safe, supportive, equitable, and engaging school environments that aren't only good for trauma-impacted kids, but also for everyone in the school community, teachers, playground staff, other classmates, families. So one of the biggest shifts that we believe needs to happen in order to try to do this work is a big shift in perspective. And this is what, in some ways, the ACEs study has given us, trauma research has given us, this perspective that if something frightening is happening in front of you, someone is kind of off the chain and they're losing it. Instead of asking the question, what is wrong with you? Can we ask the question, what has happened to you? Not out loud necessarily, but in our minds, because when we ask the question, what's wrong with you, it leads us to thinking, this person's bad, they need to be punished, right? And when we ask the question, what's happened to you, instead it provides a context for the behavior. And that context then allows us to connect with that person, because we can relate. Oh, that happened to them. Wow. And that compassion, that connection then helps us to see the strengths that people bring to bear despite their adversity. And all of this helps us to be able to respond to what's happened instead of just the reaction that happens that tends to push people away and push people out. And I'm going to skip this slide because we don't have a lot of time, but I want to say that our program, HEARTS, is a whole school program. We're really trying to change the whole school culture to make it more safe and supportive. And so this is a public health approach to trauma. We know this is science put into action. We're taking the science of how to address trauma for individuals and building it out into how we do it in school buildings. So we have a primary prevention approach, or a sort of a universal supports approach, where we train all of the people in the school building about what chronic stress and trauma does to us as human beings, and that what anybody can do, regardless of what their role is in the school, to try to make it a more safe and supportive, equitable, and engaging school. We work with kids who are already exhibiting some of the difficulties that might come out of experiencing trauma, and then we also provide on-site really intensive psychotherapy if there's funding for that. So it's been a journey that's been very humbling, and in partnership with the school where we've done work with them since the 2009-10 school year, we've seen tremendous decreases in disciplinary office referrals. After 5 years, 87% decrease in those disciplinary office referrals. I'm going to write a referral, you got to go to the principal's office kind of thing. As 86% decrease in incidents of physical aggression incidents, and after 5 years, a 95% decrease in out-of-school suspensions. It's pretty much something that they don't do anymore. And that is because of that shift, right? These aren't bad kids or rude kids or lazy kids. These are frightened kids who are doing their best to survive. This is the roadmap that we've been using to try to help people do this work. And it's a little bit of a complicated graphic, but what I want to say is that we've got these six principles, and I'm just going to name them. They're understanding trauma and stress. It's promoting cultural humility and responsiveness. This is about equity. It's creating safety and predictability. It's building compassionate and dependable relationships between teachers and students, between the school staff and the school, between the school and families, right? It's drawing on people's resilience and the things that they've done to adapt to their adversity, and not sort of poo-pooing those, but actually building on the strengths that they bring to the school, and really explicitly teaching social-emotional learning skills, which are the kinds of things like, have empathy and communication skills and be self-aware. There's wonderful curricula in schools to do that, and we have the tools at our disposal. My water, please. And finally, we need to empower the people in the school to have voice and choice around how their school day goes and how they're learning, and making sure that if there are difficulties, they have things that they can say. And this isn't only for students. This is actually not just for students. It's for teachers. We want teachers to feel safe and have compassionate, dependable relationships. The schoolyard. And we want the principals and the leadership to feel that way. And so this is how we do the whole school culture change. The metaphor that we use for some of the things that have been talking about here, in order for kids to learn, they have to have their learning brains on, right? That's that prefrontal cortex. And we talk about a rider and a horse. And the learning part of the brain we think about as the rider, right? Sits up top and can kind of see, where we need to go and prioritize. And the lower parts of the brain, the amygdala that Nadine was talking about, we think about that as the horse. It's very powerful, and it acts on protective instincts based on feelings. And what happens if you've got a rider and a horse, they're working together in an integrated way, you can get pretty far. You can do a lot of work. But what happens when people are triggered by a trauma reminder, something that it might not even actually be a threat, but maybe like a hard look from the teacher or a loud noise in the classroom, is that the rider falls off the horse, right? And what you're left with is the part of the brain that is a nonverbal, terrified creature. And so if we try to use the sort of normal, traditional teaching bag of tricks, so consequences, rewards, think sheets, think about what you did and what you could have done differently, but a kid's rider is off their horse, right? That can actually make things worse, right? And the other thing is that we try to teach teachers that it's not only students whose riders fall off their horses, sometimes it's the adults too. And don't we want to make sure that our riders are firmly on our horses before we try to mete out some kind of consequence, right? And the other piece that I really want to emphasize here is that we're not just talking about individuals. organizations are made up of living beings like you and I, right? And so organizations actually act like living organisms. And what happens when you have an organization like a school filled with super stressed out, under-resourced people is that there's this gravitational pull towards disorganization, towards disintegration, where teams of teachers and administrators and support staff aren't working well together, where you have finger-pointing and blaming, and it's his fault and her fault and that person's fault, or where you have all of these fear-based responses, this over focus on threat reduction. So it's all about control, right, and rules, and you better stay inside the box or you're in trouble. And unfortunately, that is at the expense of relationship and creativity and growth and development. So we need to think about how we make our organizations more safe and supportive so that the very organizations that we have to try to serve people don't cause harm in and of themselves, right? The other thing I just want to name here in my last few minutes is the understanding. This is one of our principles. It's a foundational principle. It's about practicing cultural humility and responsiveness. So this may be a new word for some of you. We often hear words like cultural competence. But cultural humility is reflecting together as a community about the root causes of suffering. Things like historical racism and institutional racism, right? And then what we need to do as individuals and institutions to make sure we're not continuing to perpetuate those harms. Because the true fact is, things like racism can be experienced as a trauma in and of itself, right? It's that looming threat that somehow my safety, my well-being, my voice isn't as important as someone else's because of an accident of birth, the color of my skin, who I love, how I walk. Right, and so if we think about this in this way, the sort of centered circle here is trauma as we normally think about it, exposure to violence and ACEs as we in its traditional form. But trauma happens in a context. It happens in the context of societal oppressions, that outer circle. And when you put those things together, there's actually a synergistic effect potentially of trauma. And so if we are only addressing the inner circle and not addressing things like racism and sexism and homophobia, we are missing the boat. So that is very central, we believe, to making a safe, supportive, equitable school or health system. So this is our roadmap. And here are all of our principles. I want to say that what we know now from the science is that we can all heal from trauma. It's absolutely possible to rewire the brain towards more healthy functioning, right? What we're learning is that when we employ trauma-informed, culturally responsive, equity-promoting practices that establish safety, that foster compassionate and dependable relationships, because it's relationships that heal, right? It's relationships that heal. When we empower people to make positive changes and make better choices, we can transform trauma and help everyone in a school community develop and learn and thrive. So thank you very much for your time.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California with Jane Stevens, Dr. Nadine Britt Harris, Joyce Dorado, and our wonderful moderator, James Redford, who, by the way, is the director and producer of the Resilience documentary. And I'm going to turn this over to James now for the question cards. We have questions from the audience. And James, you're on.
Yeah, we have a pretty smart audience, as it turns out. So, Jane, I'm going to toss this to you, and you can thank me later. What role can law enforcement, police, sheriffs, district attorney, probation officers play in addressing ACEs beyond just being aware of the issue of trauma, so to speak?
Thanks, Jamie. As I mentioned, of the 12,000 members that are part of ACEs Connection, people come from all walks of life, including law enforcement, DAs, probation. And It's the people who are on the cutting edge who are taking this new knowledge and saying, we've been doing everything wrong and we're going to do something different. So, for example, in Kansas City, what they police department has done there as a start for this, which is actually following the way that Joyce works in schools, which is saying to the police department, look, you all come with a lot of ACEs. I mean, they didn't say it quite that bluntly, but they explain to the police officers, yes, you are under a lot of stress. We acknowledge that. And that some things that are happening out on your beat or what you do during the day or night are triggering you because of what's happened to you in your childhood. So let's start dealing with that. Well, there was such an overwhelming response, a positive response to this, that the police officers themselves have done things like start mindfulness classes and yoga classes, exercise classes. They understand this. This is not brain science, rocket science. It's brain science. It's not rocket science. And they're beginning to use it. And what Joyce taught me is that you really have to take this in to yourself first before you can help anybody else. It's old, like putting the oxygen mask on yourself before you put on your kids when you're on an airplane. So I think that's the way it's starting out. And that seems to be the way it's starting out in all of these departments is what are we bringing to this? And then, gee, if we're feeling this, what must our clients or the people that we're trying to help feeling? And then let's look at all of our policies and practice through this lens and see what we need to change. It's slow, but I think once people start doing it, there's no going back. And that's the good news.
Thank you, Jane. So, Dr. Harris, someone in our audience heard about a multi-year grant, perhaps even to CYW, from Google to develop data systems around ACEs. What is the status of that project, if that's in fact true? And I will add, if it's true or not, do you have any light to shed on what it means to be doing this work and seeking community support from the likes of Silicon Valley?
certainly. So it's very true that Google.org has been one of our biggest supporters at the Center for Youth Wellness. And several years ago, they really made a big bet on us to do a grant. It wasn't to support data systems per se, but specifically it was to support the treatment of our patients and for us to advance our clinical protocol. And what has happened as a result of our support from Google is that the Center for Youth Wellness has codified our clinical approach to screening for adverse childhood experiences in the primary care setting, in the pediatric office. And we pull that together into a clinical protocol and actually made it available for free on our website. Our goal was to get 1,000 pediatricians to download this tool over the course of 3 years. In the first 14 months that our screening protocol went live, we've had over 1,200 clinicians in 15 countries download our screening protocol for screening for adverse childhood experiences.
Terrific. I like a little good news, particularly these days. Anyway, moving on. So how can we, Joyce, this is for you. How can we get involved to shift policy and education in collaboration with other professions like those that are working in neuroscience or straight ahead in medicine, juvenile judges, other public sector, other service-oriented sectors. How can we do that in a collaborative way?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great question. And
What we know about trauma, ultimately, is that trauma fragments. It fragments the way our brain and bodies work together, and it also tends to fragment systems. When we have trauma-impacted, stressed-out systems, they don't work very well together. And so we do need to take a collective impact approach. And an example of that is the state Supreme Court Chief Justice's Keeping Kids in School and Out of Court initiative, which puts together, these judges have convened juvenile justice, child welfare, education, public health, parent advocacy organizations, all to work together so that our systems are working together instead of working in silos and fragments. And so that kids that sort of prevention can happen in schools. And I do think part of it is really recognizing the fragmentation so that we can actively counteract that gravitational pull. And I also think it is really making sure that people understand that ACEs and trauma is not just the purview of mental health, but it is the purview of public health, and it is the purview of, it is in fact an educator's job to help keep kids' riders on their horses so that they can learn, right? It is in fact the job of a juvenile justice worker or of a police officer to help keep the person that they're intervening with's rider on their horse so that things don't escalate into a tragedy, and also the understanding that we each bring potentially our own ACEs and trauma to the table. So when we recognize that it's like all of us together, I think that that's how we get people to work together.
And so that is one thing I wanted to add to that statement is that 2 years ago, the Center for Youth Wellness convened California's first statewide summit on adverse childhood experiences. And at that time, we brought together more than 30 stakeholder organizations across the state, including the Department of Public Health, the Department of Justice, some of our educational leaders. And for the past 2 years, we've been working in partnership with a children's advocacy organization called Children Now to really think about crafting thoughtful policy recommendations that we can implement to use California as a test case. And we've just transformed this into an initiative called the California Campaign to Counter Childhood Adversity. It's 4CA. And I'll give you an example about why this policy work is so important. I spoke earlier about seeing a patient in clinic and screening them for ACEs and what the recommendation was to connect them to services. But last year, there was a measure that went before the governor to allow a primary care doctor, a pediatrician like myself, to be able to see a patient on the same day as a mental health provider. Currently, the law in California does not allow for a doctor and a mental health provider to see the patient on the same day. They won't pay for it, right? So in our center, we have created this amazing state-of-the-art center where I can see a patient and the same day before they leave my office, before I have that attrition, walk them down the hall and say, I'd like to introduce you to my colleague. But the law in the state of California won't allow us to get reimbursed for it. These type of barriers need to come down.
Amen.
Yeah, and also I just wanted to add, that's one of the things that we do on ACEs Connection, as I mentioned, with the communities that we're working with. We're actually developing tools for communities to use to identify the sectors in their community and the subsectors so that they can make sure that they're reaching everybody and bringing everybody together at the table. First to educate them and then to engage them in this initiative and then to get them to start activating and doing something in their own work and their own organization to become trauma-informed and then celebrate, you know, telling the stories and celebrating their progress in this.
You know, I'll just say that during my look at all of this, if I didn't
bear witness to and understand that there are some really powerful solutions. I never would have made these movies. It would have not been inspiring me just to point out bad news about what stress does. It was clear to me right off the bat that unless there were solutions, I could not make the kind of movie that I am particularly interested in making. And luckily, it's all out there, and I hope all of you that have been here tonight can hear with our esteemed guest here that there's plenty of opportunity and there's a lot of great work going on. Thank you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Resilience, Children, Hope, Research, and the Environment. And unfortunately, we have in fact come to the end of our program, which has been very informative. And I certainly personally have learned a lot and really appreciate the panel being here. Our panel tonight, as I mentioned before, has consisted of Jane Stevens, who's a founder publisher of ACES Connection. Excuse me. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris from the University of California, San Francisco, Center for Youth Wellness. Joyce Dorado, PhD, University of California, San Francisco, Healthy Environments and Response to Trauma in Schools. And our wonderful moderator tonight has been James Redford. He is the director and producer of the Resilience documentary. By the way, a documentary that has won numerous awards. So we can honor that because we know that it's such an important area to actually bring to everyone and inform them and help them. So the documentary, of course, is one of those ways that James and his work has always focused on in terms of just really informing and exposing and bringing together things that are very important in our lives. So we really thank James tonight for being our moderator. And so let's give a big hand of applause for our panel. We really have had a terrific panel, and my thanks to them. Now, my many thanks to our terrific sold-out audience here tonight to hear this wonderful presentation. So let's give our audience here a big round of applause. And another round of applause to our audience on the radio and the Internet. One more round of applause. Find our programs on the Internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on the website for programs and registrations. Click on Watch and Listen for Commonwealth Club videos, radio schedules, and subscribe to our weekly free podcasts and program archives. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you all for being with us tonight, our audiences, our panel, for a terrific and wonderful and very meaningful presentation tonight. Look for our programs again. We will begin back here in the Commonwealth Club in February 2017, and we have some really exciting programs coming. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you, everyone.